Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I report and investigate the latest in a planetary transformation that seems to be happening with everyone and everywhere. And tonight's guest is very much involved in that kind of discovery, that kind of those ideas that are being put out about how we can change the planet, reshape the world. The Choice is the name of his book, Using Conscious Thought and Physics of the Mind to Reshape the World. His name is Mike Barra, and he is an aerospace engineering consultant. He's also the co-author of Dark Mission with Richard Hoagland. And thanks, Mike. You're there?
Yeah, I'm here. It's great to be with you, Alan.
Thanks. So, there's a lot of books coming out about we're at this crisis point. We're at a place where we have to decide, are we going to go into the new or are we going to keep perpetuating the past? I mean, in a way, it doesn't seem like a choice. I mean, there is only the unknown. I mean, how can we keep doing what we've been doing, which is destroying the planet, creating economic havoc and war and destruction? It's not really a choice. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, Alan, I'm not quite as pessimistic as you are on the state of the world, but certainly what feels like it's happening is that, you know, everything's being polarized and everything's being pushed to kind of a dramatic, what I think is going to be a real dramatic, choice point for us, where we're going to have to all decide which side of the fence we're going to fall on. And I think, that's why I decided to write the book. That's what really inspired me, was to get people to appreciate that they have a role to play in this, and that things are going to just start to shift, you know, whether we like it or not, things are going to shift. But we really do have the free will, the choice, the option to decide how everything is going to turn out. And that includes our monetary system, our form of government, and even changes to the earth itself are all within our control if we simply decide to participate in the upcoming apocalypse.
Right, and we'll talk about what apocalypse means, but just going back, I think it's very optimistic. I think the world, though, will, through conscious effort and maybe not so conscious effort, move to a place of harmony and, you know, a new understanding. And yeah, people have to decide, but when you say the choice, what do people have to consciously do? What are you suggesting they do?
Well, I try to make a distinction in the book, in The Choice. I try to make a distinction between the secret and the choice. And the distinction would be between attraction and choice, because what the secret's really all about is, you know, material things. It's about selfish things. It's about asking for stuff for yourself. And what I'm trying to tell people is that the way forward, the way to make the entire planet better off, is to choose for other people the kind of world we want to live in. In other words, think of others first. Think of when you sit down to pray or meditate or whatever it is that you do in your spiritual life, to think not just, oh, I want this, oh, I want that, oh, I want the other thing, but also think about and focus on, you know, the people in your family, your friends, your city, your community, your state, your country, your world. Focus on that positive energy, that positive idea of how you want the world to be. I mean, you mentioned a whole bunch of things at the top of the hour that you feel like are wrong with the world. So start to consciously think about a world without those things, a world without war, a world without conflict, a world with plenty of food, plenty of abundance, and a healthy environment. And what I'm trying to get people to do is say, if you understand that if that's the world you create, almost by definition, you're going to have a happy, healthy, materially comfortable life within that world that you've created. So what I'm trying to get people to focus on is their choice in exactly how they want the world to be.
Right. No, I agree. And I do think we've had enough war and we've had enough suffering. And I mean, I'd like to think it was that easy, and maybe it is that easy. I mean, I just heard a program on Coast to Coast about the Kennedy assassination, who really runs the government, and how Oswald was really a CIA agent, and I'm convinced that that might be true. And if that is true, then how do we change a government that's an illusion to begin with?
Well, you know, interestingly, I was just talking about the Kennedy assassination today, and I have kind of a different take on who really killed Kennedy and why, and it's all in my first book that I did with Richard Hoagland in Dark Mission. But, you know, how do we change a government? What the physics says, my book, you know, The Choice, is a lot of it is about physics. It's about the real physics of the universe and how it really works and what the real laws of physics are. And what's going to happen over these next few years, not just between now and 2012, but all the way through to 2023, is that these government structures are going to collapse. They are simply going to be stressed beyond the point where they will be able to function. And so what will have to happen is that we will have to choose a new way of doing things and a new government for ourselves. So, you know, you really see that already. No matter what you think of the Tea Party movement, there's no question it was a powerful, almost, you know, third party movement that was nominally aligned with the Republican Party, but was not endorsed by them to speak of, and that the party hierarchy was not comfortable with. Certainly the Democrats didn't like them, and the news media didn't like them. So these established power structures were all and are all deeply threatened by the existence of this populist movement called the Tea Party, and the reality is that it's much more powerful than any of the traditional hierarchies and structures. And so under certain interpretations of the Mayan calendar, what's going to happen over the next couple years, you know, all these kinds of government-oriented hierarchical structures are going to become really, really, you know, become really stressed out, really get themselves into a lot of trouble, and they're just going to sort of cease to exist and cease to be relevant on their own.
Can I ask you who you did think killed Kennedy?
I think it was a essentially a Masonic conspiracy through basically, you know, organized by President Johnson to keep the United States from sharing the technology of our space program with the Soviet Union, and with and also to keep from sharing the discoveries that we were about to make on the moon of what was once a very advanced civilization there. And Kennedy appeared clearly to intend to share all that stuff with the Soviet Union, and 10 days after he issued an executive order that dictated that the CIA and NASA open offices and begin information exchange with the Soviet Union, he was dead. And I think that's clearly what got him killed.
Well, I mean, don't you think those elements are about the choice as well? If that's true and there is an advanced civilization, how can we make a choice if we don't know the facts? I mean, some of that has to come out, like the whole UFO cover up in general, if we're going to make
absolutely. And again, in the book, in The Choice, that's what I talk about, is how the physics and the astrology that's connected to the physics is going to drive revelations. I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier the apocalypse, and most people don't understand that the word apocalypse simply means to lift a veil or reveal that which has been hidden, and that is the world in which we're going to be living for the next several years. Things are going to come out. Truths are going to be told. There's nothing anybody's going to be able to do to you know, put the genie back in the bottle. And revelation after revelation after revelation is going to take place, and that is in of itself going to collapse these structures. They're simply not going to be able to hold up under the lies that they've been telling for literally a couple thousand years now. I mean, we've been in the age of Pisces, and we're now moving into the astrological age of Aquarius. The Pisces is an occult age or a hidden age where things are kept from us, and Aquarius is the symbol of Aquarius is the water bearer, the pourer of water down upon, you know, upon the earth. And that symbol, its symbolic meaning, has always been knowledge. Knowledge will be poured down upon us, and we will suddenly begin to understand our place in the universe, who we really are, what we've really been, and all the lies that we've been told. So the physics is just going to drive this out in the open. There's nothing that's going to stop it.
Well, I always thought it was interesting that Aquarius is an air sign as opposed to water, and you get these waves in the air. So like all this wireless stuff is already the beginning of an Aquarian age, I think. You know, it's
that's an interesting way to describe it, that the waves of wireless energy are part of this awakening that's going on, this you know, wave of knowledge that's going to hit people and basically keep, you know, they're not going to be able to just hide behind their football games and their distractions and their drugs and their dancing anymore. People are going to have to confront the reality that things have really not been working the way they're supposed to be working, and we're going to have to start taking responsibility for making things better.
I agree with you, but I mean, everything you're saying, but the other day I was at a shopping mall in Middle America, and have you been out to one of those recently where, you know, all the stores are prefab and they're all, you know, franchise? Those people, I don't know if those people know that there is a choice, really.
Well, no, they don't. But, you know, again, what the Mayan calendar says and what the physics seems to back up that I talk about in the book is that people are going to start to awaken whether they like it or not. Now, not everybody's going to awaken at the same time. But the truth is, people like you and me, we're already awake. We're already aware of the shifts that are going on, and we've already taken responsibility for our part in it. And so, unfortunately, you have a responsibility. You and I have a greater responsibility to be there for those people when they do wake up and start asking us, yeah, what's going on? Why is everything so strange? You know, why are there these big UFOs over American cities all of a sudden? Why doesn't the government seem to be able to function? Why is the banking system collapsing? All these things are going to really scare the hell out of people, and they're going to be forced to deal with them, and they're going to need guys like you and guys like me to be there to tell them what's going on and what they can do to fix it.
Yeah, and we are there, and we are doing things like this radio show that is mm-hmm. part of the revelation. I just know a shift of an age is not just overnight, and I do think 2012 will be something. I do think it will be a revelation, but I know from going from Pisces to Aquarius is a couple of hundred years of realigning our values, our belief system. It's a whole mindset that has to change, and that doesn't change overnight.
No, it does not change overnight, but we are at the beginning and very volatile stage of this. And, you know, again, I mean, people do have opinions on when, you know, ages specifically change and has to do with the vernal equinox and all that stuff, but I don't know that the physics necessarily agrees with that. So that's one of the things I've actually set out for myself to study some more is the shifting of ages, exactly when do ages shift, and what's the astrological definition, and how do those alignments necessarily affect consciousness? Because again, one of the things I talk about in The Choice very extensively is the effect on consciousness of actual physical planetary alignments and astrological aspects. So I'm not sure we can necessarily say that this age is going to take hundreds and hundreds of years for us to get to that point. It may be much sooner than that. I've got to really look into the details.
How do you, with a kind of advanced physics or physics of the mind, merge astrology and consciousness and hardcore physics and quantum physics together? How do you make sense of all of that at a new level?
Well, quantum physics, first of all, I don't pay any attention to because it's completely wrong, and I have zero faith in any of the standard, you know, physical models that are out there. What I'm talk about in the book is something called hyperdimensional physics, which basically says that all energy comes from a higher spatial dimension, dimensions beyond this one. And I talk in there very extensively. I show you examples of specific scientific experiments that have been done where electromagnetic energy was very specifically affected by the geometric configuration of the planets in the solar system. When certain, you know, planets, especially the big Jovian planets that have a lot of the spin energy, are in certain positions, it can dramatically affect electrical instruments. And the thing to appreciate is that these electrical instruments are basically just you know, electromagnetic energy flowing back and forth and being measured. And that's exactly what goes on in our minds. Our brains are nothing more than, our thoughts are nothing more than transmitted electromagnetic energy. So if radio signals, for instance, radio waves, can be affected by the relative positions of the planets, then also our thoughts can be affected in the same way. And there's a lot of different experiments that have been shown that indicate that these very specific alignments, positive or negative aspects of astrology, had positive and negative effect on radio signals. So to me, it's not much of a leap. I go to you know, quite a bit of detail in the choice to actually show people examples that have been out there in the experimental database for years, but they're just poorly understood or generally ignored by mainstream physicists because it doesn't fit their paradigm, which is right now quantum physics.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm really interested in the higher spatial physics, the hyperdimensional physics, because I think some of the crop circles are showing exactly that, especially this season, with the cubes, overlapping cubes, and the tetra tetrahedrons that were showing up there. So how do you explain a hyperdimensional, a fourth, fifth, sixth dimensional space?
Well, I can't explain it. I cannot tell you what it looks like. I cannot tell you what the world is like there. All I can do is maybe, say, talk to some psychics that have connections to that higher spatial dimension. I really can't describe it. All I can do is I can show you the effects that energy moving through those higher dimensions actually has on us here in three dimensions. So it's really more of a question of, we simply can't perceive what those dimensions are like. All we can do is measure their effect on our three-dimensional reality. And one of the best examples, I guess, I can give of this is what I described earlier, which is these alignments of planets. For instance, my co-author on Dark Mission, Richard C. Hoagland, did some experiments in Albuquerque in 2006 and in Florida, Coral Castle, in 2004 during a Venus transit. Now, a Venus transit is an eclipse, an alignment of basically Venus and the Earth and the Sun. Now, he set up an instrument. It was a tuning fork. It's a very, very sensitive, vibrating device. And when Venus passed in front of the disk of the Sun, the thing basically went crazy. It started vibrating off the chart much more rapidly. It was clearly being affected by some sort of energy wave, and in the book I describe it as torsion, coming through the ether because it was actually traveling faster than light. So, and affecting this instrument here on Earth. So, you know, again, there's a substantial experimental database out there that will show us that these kinds of things, which are basically considered impossible in quantum physics or in relativistic physics or in any of the modern conventional three-dimensional ways of thinking that we've been trapped in for a couple hundred years now, do take place, and they do happen. There's a thing called the LA effect, where a pendulum, a free-swinging pendulum, which normally would go swing with the rotation of the Earth during eclipses over France, over Paris, France in the 1950s, actually started to very rapidly swing backwards against the rotation of the Earth. And again, that's just plain impossible by any of the standard acceptable laws of physics, unless you include higher dimensions in the equations and in the predictions. And then when you do that, what you get is you get the possibility that the movements of the planets are actually sending waves of energy through this hyperdimensional ether, through these higher dimensions, and they are being reflected down here in our three dimensions and affecting physical instruments on this planet.
Is that how you, one way to possibly explain astrology through that? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, that's what I say in the book, is that, you know, it's the astronomy that drives the astrology, because what you're getting is you're getting these waves of energy from the planets, and it's connected to spin. It's connected to the rapid spinning of these planets. The more spin energy or angular momentum a celestial body has, the more of an influence it can have on physical and physical reality and consciousness here on the Earth. So that's exactly what's going on, and that's why the big planets, you know, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus, have such a dramatic effect in some of these experiments that I've talked about, because they have the most spin energy, so they're putting out the most hyperdimensional, the strongest waves of hyperdimensional energy that's affecting us here on the planet.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the galaxy itself, I mean, a lot of suns out there, stars, seem to have mm-hmm. those larger planet. So what does that kind of hyper-dimensional soup look like on that level, you know?
Well, what that means, and this is really critically important, is that all physics are local. They're not, it's a localized phenomenon. In other words, there's a big picture physics, which is kind of the way that that the entire universe works, but in each individual solar system, which is going to have different spin energy, planetary configurations, different alignments, the minute physical laws, the smaller stuff, is going to be different. Should be different. The speed of light should be marginally different in different places of
there's
the galaxy.
Local,
than it is
that's
here.
Original. I haven't heard anyone else say there's localized laws of nature is what you're saying.
Yeah, basically. The speed of light, for instance, is a local phenomenon. And I think that that's what's happening with the so-called Pioneer effect. You've got the Voyager and Pioneer probes, which have left the solar system, and they seem to be inexplicably slowing down. And there's really nothing that they can account for out there that would be holding up these two particular space probes. And what I think is really going on is that the radio signals, which travel at the speed of light, are actually traveling a little bit faster out there beyond the, they call it the shock plane, or the basically out beyond the limits of the solar system, which is where those two probes are now. The speed of light is just minutely slightly different, and as a result, the signals are not coming in as they predict, and they're thinking there's some big giant planet out there which is pulling them towards it or keeping them from escaping the solar system, slowing them down. In reality, what's happening is just that the speed of light is slightly different, so the radio signals aren't traveling quite as fast.
But, you know, all this goes along with my theory I'm developing about sort of laws of consciousness, in the sense that our local sun dictates the kind of awareness of our consciousness. And when we meet ETs, they are in a different awareness because their star vibrates from a different kind of source configuration.
Yeah, different frequencies. Basically, there's a different amount of energy. It's got a different, probably a different amount of angular momentum.
But that affects their consciousness.
Sure.
It affects the consciousness of those ETs, so that's why when you meet an ET, your consciousness is shifted to an altered state.
Right. Right, and it makes sense, too, because, you know, again, some people are going to be more sensitive to these higher states of vibration. Therefore, they're maybe going to have the experience where somebody else sitting right next to them doesn't, because they're slightly shifted just a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right or a little bit faster or a little bit slower into that resonance with that extraterrestrial consciousness. I think that's absolutely valid, and I think as things get more and more interesting and stranger and stranger, more and more people are going to start having these kinds of experiences, because it's really interesting that you brought this up. In the book, in the choice, I talk about the yuga cycles and the belief that the ancient Vedic Hindus had in an object called Vishnu Nabhi, or the Vishnu Nabhi, or Vishnu's navel, which they said was a large stellar object that the sun orbited around about every 24 to 26,000 years. And they said that when our path to that Vishnu Nabhi is clear, in other words, there's a way for us to receive the light energy and the life energy from it, then our consciousness was raised, and when it was blocked, our consciousness was lowered. In other words, we were more in a period of darkness. And, you know, again, that completely aligns with the ancient Vedic belief systems. What you just said completely aligns with those ancient Vedic belief systems.
Right. No, that's interesting. But I'm also curious if suns or stars emanate their own local laws of physics, then that's still a subset to a kind of galactic physics. And now
there's going to be a galactic physics and a universal physics and a localized physics. And they're all going to be just slightly different and have slightly different rules. And, you know, again, I think that this is one of the things I talk about in the book also, is that in my opinion, you know, there's two missing planets right now in the solar system, two planets that used to be here that are no longer here. And exactly how they were destroyed is debatable, and we can talk about that all we want at some other time.
Wait, only the asteroid belt that I know of. Where was the other planet?
Well, the other planet was roughly in the orbit of where Mars is now, and Mars was a moon of that planet. And there's very, very clear, and I think indisputable signatures that Mars was once in a very close, tidal-locked orbital configuration with this large, massive body, which no longer exists. And, you know, there's signatures of this epic destruction all over the surface of Mars. And we talk about that in Dark Mission, Richard and I also go into it pretty extensively in The Choice. Now, the interesting thing about this is that if you lose two planets that have a lot of spin energy, let's say two large, what they call super-Earths now, they theorize about planets like this. If you lose these, then you're going to have less spin energy, less life energy in the solar system, and therefore you're going to have smaller types of life. So I think it's really interesting that, you know, this destruction of this Planet 5 in the orbit around where Mars is now is tied to about 65 million years ago at about the same time the dinosaurs were destroyed, because life back then was larger. Now on Earth there's very, very few creatures that even approach the size of the dinosaurs, and that's because there's simply less life-giving energy now in the entire connected solar system that we live in, that we inhabit.
Was that about the same time our moon was pulled into orbit? Because I think our moon is an artificially placed satellite to balance whatever needed to be balanced for life on Earth.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I don't know about the exact time frame when the moon was put here. That's a whole separate speculation that I haven't really gone off into great depth about. But absolutely, I agree with you that the moon is artificial and it performs obviously a very, very crucial function in keeping the Earth itself habitable. It's a very, very important.
I think it was only about 100,000, maybe less. It could be as little as 50,000 years ago, but people show evidence that we went from a 360-day year to what it is now, 365 and a quarter, and that had to do with the moon being pulled into place and also the Earth expanding out from the sun a little bit. So
yeah, I talk about that in The Choice, and I think, you know, what I think is that this planet was destroyed or it blew up or whatever happened to it. Mars was devastated, Venus was devastated, and the Earth was hit by quite a few objects, and these objects probably pushed the Earth into a slightly more elliptical and slightly more elongated orbit, and it added those extra 5 days. I agree with you. I think that was probably right about that time.
Although my theory about Venus is that the cloud covering are the oceans that have yet to descend and create the life that will be on Venus. And so I think the planets go through stages. We have the yet to have life Venus, we have life on Earth, and then we have the extinction of life on Mars. It seems like that's a sort of progression, doesn't it?
Well, that's a possibility. I tend to disagree with you a little bit. I think that the clouds on Venus are actually the vaporized oceans that because the planet was a life-giving world. It was just like the Earth and Mars, which were all life-bearing. And what I think happened was that a large chunk of this destruction of this Planet 5 or Planet V hit Venus and at an angle at many, many, many tens of thousands of miles an hour and just vaporized the oceans and created the kind of hellish cloud cover we have now. Because if you look at Venus, if you look at the radar maps, there's this huge gash that runs about two-thirds of the way around the planet. And it looks like that the planet was rotating. This chunk of it hit edge on and just basically carved this big scar all the way all the way along the planet, most of the way around the planet. And that's what I think happened, but that's my theory, and I'll have to ask somebody who's more in the know than I am.
What about Velikovsky? Have you read his work? Velikovsky?
I'm sorry? I've read Velikovsky's work. I talk a little bit about Velikovsky and The Choice. And it's definitely, definitely interesting stuff. And I don't think that Venus is a comet that was ejected from Jupiter. I really don't.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so either. I think the sun is actually birthing new planets. I mean, maybe not right now, but I think that's the process of planet formation, is emerging from the sun as congealed gases.
Yeah, well, and again, that's another thing I talk about in The Choice. I talk about the fact that I don't believe in the planetary accretion model. It seems to be wrong. And so if you think about it like this, a sun begins to form through the collapse and gathering of all this nebular material, and it begins to get larger and larger and larger and spin faster and faster and faster until it finally ignites, and it continues to just suck up more and more energy from this debris that's in this nebular cluster. And eventually what happens is it gets to be spinning so fast that it fissions off, literally from its belly, it fissions off all the planets. Now, this would explain why, as we look at some solar systems, there's these gigantic hot Jupiters that appear to be almost as hot as the stars that they orbit, the size of Jupiter, and they're basically right next to these stars. They're within the orbit of Mercury in terms of their distance. And in the accretion model, there's just no way to explain that. But in the fission model, what you're seeing is you're seeing these young, gaseous, hot Jupiters that have just been ejected from their parent stars and are slowly but surely, over probably millions of years, going to spiral away from that main star until they reach a resonant orbit. It's part of literally the birthing process of solar systems. And I agree with you. I think that's exactly how it works, and I go into that actually quite extensively in the choice.
So, yeah, I mean, you're the type of person I would like to ask, because you've studied physics and aerospace and astrophysics and consciousness. How is it that there's this incredibly large, galaxies and galaxies, universe of balls of energy, and there's this thing called consciousness? Is consciousness the ground of all being? Is consciousness a product of those stars? I mean, what's your take, and how do you fit those two things that seem very, very different together?
That is beyond the scope of the choice. It's like I don't know how consciousness forms. I don't know what mechanism creates it. I mean, I do talk about how the fact that the planets do affect our consciousness. I go into that in great detail in the choice. But honestly, Alan, I just don't know. I mean, I think it's a question that's way beyond me. What forms consciousness? I mean, what forms the animal kingdom? They have consciousness. Why are they different? What role do they play in our lives? I mean, I'm going to be writing a book about that, I think, next year. But, I don't know. That's beyond my pay grade. It's beyond what I can answer in this book.
No, but that's sort of, in a way, the ultimate question. Does consciousness emerge as an emerging factor of matter, or did consciousness exists before all this and then condensed into form? I mean, of course, there's no way to know for sure.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of people that believe that's the case. I mean, I think certainly what you can do is you look at the fossil record of the planet Earth, and it appears to me that what happens is, if you read, there's an excellent book by actually Lloyd Pye called Everything You Know Is Wrong, Book One, Human Origins. And he really goes into extensive detail to describe how evolution is really a bunch of baloney. And what happens is that species seem to spring into existence fully formed. They last about a million years, and then they die out in some sort of catastrophe. And, that being the case, he puts forth what he calls the cosmic dump truck theory, which is basically that somebody seems to drive by this particular planet and say, oh, this looks like a really good place to stick some life. Let's dump some there and see what happens. And then the consciousness seems to inhabit these bodies that are placed here that have this capability of containing a higher consciousness. I don't know. We can speculate forever, but...
You can speculate. But, I mean, I think part of that's true, but I think what does create the mutations is not Darwin's theory, but high intense solar galactic radiations that mutate species overnight, practically, And so they're not all radiation is... doesn't destroy life, it mutates it in favorable ways. I mean, that's my own private theory of evolution.
It's a possibility also.
But getting back to your book, I know we went off the course, but I do like the physics that you're talking about, and you talk a lot about torsion fields. Now tell us why, I mean, sort of you've been talking about that a little bit, but why is that such an important point for you? And
well,
what is it?
Because, as you're looking, the question, the argument always is, okay, if this hyperdimensional energy exists, what is it and how does it work? And they say, well, you guys don't have anything that can really explain that. And the reality is there is something called torsion that does explain it. Now, Einstein originally modeled torsion way, way back in the beginning of his relativity equations, but it was considered or thought to be just a very small force that was very much localized, for instance, to basically just to the atom and an electron within the atom. So what's been happening is that eventually there was some research done in the 1970s that talked about torsion. There was a very bunch of very fascinating papers by Dr. Nikolai Kozyrev in Russia on torsion. And essentially what torsion is it's a sort of spiraling movement, a left to right spiraling movement of energy. And there's a lot of evidence, in fact, that everything in the universe essentially moves in this way and in this direction. For instance, the sun's orbit around the center of the galaxy, everybody assumes it's circular, which it is, but also it sort of goes up and down like a wave. We go up and we go down through the galactic arm, the Orion arm that we're in. And we also spin and twist and rotate in this left-to-right torsional movement. So basically, it seems to be the force that explains all these hyperdimensional effects that we're getting. There's experiments done by Dr. Bruce De Palma in the 1970s on what was a very specifically directional, torsional kind of twisting, spinning effect. So essentially what you're talking about is that energy, this energy when it comes from these higher dimensions, manifests itself in 3D in this directional kind of a beam pattern that goes, you know, left to right, like a railgun or something in the old Quake video games.
So there's a sort of field effect, you're saying, almost from these higher dimensions that affect this dimension? Is that one way of
saying
it?
Right. Well, for instance, when you have a spinning object, let's say that right now there's a belief that there's a giant singularity at the center of the galaxy. I don't like to say black hole because black hole implies this big gravity matter-sucking monster at the center of the galaxy that's sucking everything in. In fact, what appears to be there is some large object that is incredibly massive, spinning incredibly fast, and it's actually putting energy out. Now, what we're saying is the pattern in which that energy is going to come out is going to be this twisting, spinning, serpent-like torsional energy, and it's going to come out from the north and south poles, and it's going to come out from the equator of this spinning object in very specific bursts, like the beam from a lighthouse. You know, if you're standing on the shore and a lighthouse comes around, and every so often you're going to be in alignment with that light beam, you're going to see that, you're going to get hit by it. And that, in fact, is what seems to be happening to us around this December 21st date for the last, 15, 20 years, and it'll go on until about 2016 because we're in alignment with this energy force coming from the center of the galaxy.
So we're going to be hit by this light beam from the galactic center that, like, as we've been saying, somehow these galactic forces affect consciousness, and that's part of what we're anticipating.
Well, what I talk about in The Choice, I talk about, you know, basically this wave of energy from the center of the galaxy. And my opinion is that energetically it's neutral. It really doesn't, it's not necessarily going to be a physical wave of energy. It's not necessarily going to be light. It's not necessarily going to make our consciousness rise. It's really basically just a neutral surge of energy that comes through this hyperdimensional ether, and it manifests here in 3D, and then it basically reads our intent and asks us what we want it to do with our planet when it gets here. Now, it's really interesting because the Mayans themselves have a series of predictions about what's going to happen on December 21st, 2012. There's a monument called the Tortuguero Monument, Monument Number 6 there. And it describes the fact that the god, Kukulcan or Quetzalcoatl, will ride a serpent rope from the center of the galaxy, manifest here on December 21st, 2012, and judge our planet. And so the serpent rope is an obvious reference to the spiraling, spinning, you know, torsion motion. And so the manifestation or the judgment that the Mayan calendar talks about is not the traditional Western, you know, you're good, you're bad, you go to heaven, you go to hell kind of a judgment. It's a judgment of, okay, what's your intent for this planet? So this energy is going to come whether we like it or not. It does seem to touch us consistently around December 21st in this November, December, January period every year when we're in alignment with the center of the galaxy. So really, the question then is up to us. What do you want to do with all this energy? What do you want to do with it? Do you want to make it the world something better, or do you want to make it something worse, or do you want to make it basically the same thing that it's been for the last couple of thousand years? And that's what I'm talking about with the choice. That's why I'm saying it's really important for us to set out our positive intent so that when Kukulcan gets here, he knows, oh, you guys want to go riding off in the sunset singing Kumbaya. That's what you'd rather have than, you know, another great flood like he had 13,000 years ago.
But what do you think Kukulcan will be? The ETs or just this higher dimensional revelation? How do you think it'll manifest?
Wow, I have no idea. They do say that he's going to manifest here in 3D. They do say that he's going to be a real being. And so, you know, I don't know. It could be ETs. It could be, you know, a massive solar flare. It could be this wave of positive thinking. It could be that Jupiter detonates into a second sun. It gets so spun up with energy that it becomes a second sun, and then it bathes us in its new light, and we look at the world completely differently after that. I really don't have a clue, and I think the reason that nobody knows and why there's so many good, solid theories about 2012 is because we haven't decided yet. That's what I'm trying to get people to focus on over the next couple of years, is to understand that we do get to decide, we do have a choice, and let's pick the positive outcome. That's why I wrote this book.
But if you don't believe in quantum physics, which says that the observer affects the experiment, but you do say that consciousness can affect our time-space, what are the laws of consciousness affecting matter?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's law. Again, I don't believe in laws of physics. I think everything is changeable. I think it's really up to us what kind of an experience we have. So I don't
think
that there are any laws that consciousness affects matter. What I'm saying is that what's going to happen to our planet is really up to us to choose, and therefore I'm trying to get everybody to focus on choosing something good.
Right. I'm agreeing with you. I'm just wondering if you've worked it out somehow, you know, of any, and if you've come up with your own ideas of that sort of physics that you know, how, I mean, because the universe does function in laws. I mean, the laws may change, which is something
right.
Even said.
Well, I mean, what by definition, these physical alignments of planetary bodies and the alignment of the sun and the earth and the center of the galaxy in 2012, these are by definition going to be periods where we're going to have our thoughts and our prayers and our desires are going to have an amplified effect. In other words, we're going to be able to say, you know, on certain dates and when certain eclipses take place and so forth, we're going to have the ability to affect things even more dramatically. I mean, right now, coming up in just in a few weeks, on December 21st of 2010, there is an eclipse, and I think it's basically over South America, the Southern Hemisphere, and parts of Europe. But the idea that there could be an eclipse happening, a lunar eclipse happening exactly 2 years before the end of the Mayan long count calendar, to me is not a coincidence. And I'm again focusing people on, look, I don't know exactly how this will all play itself out. It's just that all of the ancient Hopi prophecies and all of these, all the Mayan prophecies and the yuga cycles that I talk about, all these ancient writings say that what happens to us is up to us. And what I believe is that previous civilizations have chosen catastrophe. They've chosen to wipe the slate clean and start over again. So let's use these specific dates to try some specific experiments and try to amplify the positive effect for our planet.
I don't think they chose those catastrophes. I think they just weren't conscious enough not to choose them. But
That's probably a good point. Yeah, Alan, I think that that's really a good point because, you know, if you look at what the Hopis say about the previous world of man, they say that it was even more advanced than our world is today technologically. And I, by the way, I think that's a lot of the ruins that we see on the moon and on Mars is stuff from that prior human civilization. But it says that they completely lost their way. They had no spiritual beliefs at all. They were only interested in material things. And at the end, they really spent most of their time gambling. It says simply games of chance was the only thing that amused them anymore. And I agree with you. They just didn't believe in anything that wasn't of the material world. They didn't focus on spiritual things, and they got caught with their pants down and taught a lesson, and we had to start over again. And hopefully we don't have to start over again this time. I believe firmly that we're in control of the outcome of 2012 and the 2012 era that we're in.
Well, how long ago was that past civilization, the one that was destroyed? I'm just curious.
Well, that's a good question. You know, again, I think the ruins on the moon date anywhere from 2 to 3 million to 65 million years old. They've been there a long, long time. There have probably been multiple civilizations that have inhabited the moon at different times. I think that, you know, it's fairly well accepted that the great flood of the Bible was probably about 12,500 years ago, or about 10,500 BC. Now, whether that civilization was as advanced, was the really super advanced one, the Atlantean civilization they're talking about, the Hopis are talking about, I'm not sure, but I believe it was connected.
So the Atlanteans or the Noah's flood, I mean, yeah, they seem to have been an advanced civilization. I mean, the pyramids are supposedly remains from that advanced civilization that... I guess didn't see the Earth change coming, or did, and you know, but I wonder if a similar sort of Earth change is happening. But maybe again, that's up to consciousness. And what you're saying about this, the laws of physics being relative, it seems like perhaps this alignment, this 2012 alignment, which is the Earth, the Sun, the center of the galaxy, will somehow empower consciousness to make the right choice, a more powerful choice.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I talk a lot about the work of Dr. Carl Johan Kalman in The Choice, and Dr. Kalman basically breaks down the calendar into stages of human consciousness, and he says that we're right now in the next to last phase of consciousness, where we become aware that we're part not just of the Earth, but we're part of a greater galactic community, and that implies, you know, extraterrestrial visitation. It implies becoming aware of this energy pulse from the center of the galaxy and being able to tune it to something positive, tune it to our advantage. In other words, let's not have another big giant tsunami causing earthquake like we had in 2004. Instead, let's have this
hello
planet and resolving conflicts. And, you know, right now we've got a conflict between North and South Korea. And the physics says that as we come up to this point where everybody's going to have to choose, that there's going to be more and more polarization and more conflict like this. And it's just really, it's scary stuff. But again, keep in mind that it's up to us to decide the outcome of it. And we can choose to have something better than war and conflict.
Right. Just getting back to the physics, you don't really like the work of Nassim Harmim, or you don't agree with it, because I think it's brilliant in some of its ways it talks about that, those energies coming out of the singularity at the center of the galaxy and how we can build a technology. I mean,
I think it's good stuff, he doesn't know about all the experiments that have already been done in hyperdimensional physics. He's still talking about quantum physics and quantum medium and quantum blah, blah, blah. And anytime anybody says the word quantum, my eyes just roll up in my head, because to me that means I really don't know what I'm talking about here, or I'm afraid to say what I really mean, which is a hyperdimensional ether through which everything travels. And so it's not that I don't like him and respect him. I just think he needs to break away from the mainstream model completely and embrace the hyperdimensional model, because what we really need is we need a lot more experimentation along the lines of what Richard C. Hoagland has done to really get a grip on this physics and really look at how it works.
But all these quantum physicists are out there. Isn't that whole particle collider based on the quantum physics model, you know?
Theoretically, but again, there's aspects of quantum physics that are correct. But when you get into the predictions of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, for instance, they have to exclude gravity in their equations, because that's the only way that they can make their model of the universe work. So, I mean, anything that doesn't include gravity as part of its physical theory, physical model, is crazy, because you and I both know that all we have to do is go jump down the stairs and we know gravity exists. So you really look at the three pillars of modern physical theory. What you've got is you've got Newton, you've got Einstein, and you've got quantum physics. Now, with Newton, you've got these laws of motion, but the problem is they only work if you exclude rotation from the equations. Unfortunately, everything is constantly rotating, constantly moving. Every molecule in your body, every atom in your body has an electron orbiting, you know, that's constantly in rotation. The planet is rotating around the sun. The sun is rotating around the center of the galaxy. The galaxy is rotating around other galaxies. Everything is rotating, so you can kind of throw Newton out of it, out of the equation. Einstein works great on the large scale, but when you get into the small scale, Einstein and relativity kind of fell apart, and that's what basically it gave the, you know, the dawn of Max Planck and quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics only works if you exclude gravity. So none of these things can unify all of the different fields and all of the different forces that we see, except the hyperdimensional model can. And you can basically go through and look at different experiments. And I don't like to get into great detail of what happens at the subatomic level, because to me that's not important. But you can basically make everything work if you simply allow for higher spatial dimensions. That's when everything seems to fit perfectly together.
No, I agree. And I did have that discussion with Nassim, and he doesn't believe in the hyperdimensional spaces, but he does think that there are only two forces in the universe, gravity and electromagnetism, and the weak and strong force aren't really.
Well, I mean, you know, I could, I'd love to show him some of the torsion data and torsion experiments, and I'd love to debate him on that sometime. As long as we don't get into subatomic details, because I don't want to go to that.
No, I would love to. I mean, I talked to him. I'd love to set up something where, because he does talk about torsion fields, so. Mm-hmm. I would love to maybe set up a discussion between you two.
Let me give you the best example, since we're deep into the physics tonight. Let me give you the best example of where torsion applies.
Okay.
There is a theory out there called dark matter. Now, I think dark matter is the most idiotic idea I've ever heard in my life. If you go into, for instance, Wikipedia and type in dark matter, what it's going to tell you is that the problem is that where they came up with the idea of dark matter is that in a closed system, there's only X amount of energy, right? And all that energy creates, there's matter and mass create gravity. Now, as they looked around the universe, what they discovered was there wasn't nearly enough mass to create enough gravity to be holding everything together. In other words, the whole universe should have been flying apart, and it wasn't flying apart. So what did they do? What did the scientists, what did the physicists, what did the guys like Nassim Harriman decide about this lack of mass? They said, the matter must really be there. It's just invisible. Okay? Now, that's
I don't think Nassim
totally
talks
dumb.
About dark matter. I think he says the torsion that it makes up that mis-
Right.
That,
and so what I'm saying, and that's exactly what I'm saying, is that this torsional, this what I'm saying is what's really holding everything together is literally the hand of God, this torsion energy from a higher dimension. Now, remember, torsion is not necessarily the energy itself, it's just the mechanism, it's the signature through which this energy actually works, and this power actually works, this force actually manifests itself in 3D. So it's really just the signature of this higher dimensional force. And really, when you go to this higher dimensional physics, what you end up with is that, yeah, it's literally the hand of God through torsion, which is holding everything together.
Well, I love this stuff, which combines, you know, really out there physics, really advanced physics with consciousness and metaphysics. And I wish we had more time to talk about this but basically, to wrap up, the choice is that consciousness is being affected by these forces of the universe, is my summation, and we then can choose to move in a whole new direction of responsibility and compassion for the planet and each other,
right,
or not. And if we don't, then we'll have the consequences that all those past civilizations had happened to them.
Right? Yeah, and I'm saying to people, hey, you know, as long as we have a choice, let's choose the good. Let's choose to ride off into the sunset singing Kumbaya instead of having earthquakes and solar flares and floods and pole shifts and all this stuff that may have happened before. Let's choose the positive outcome this time around, and let's move forward in a better world. So what we have here is an opportunity. It's not a bad thing that the monetary system is collapsing. It's full of greed and corruption. Let's come up with something better. Let's come up with a better monetary system for the planet and for the future.
No, there's a huge difference between monetary collapse and changing solar flares and natural disasters, but you're saying we have the power to do that with our thoughts.
I'm saying, yeah, it's all connected. Remember, every human being puts out about 100 watts of electrical energy at any given moment. And every moment of creation, you are recreating that energy. You're getting that in from your higher dimension. Now, there's 7 billion of us on this planet. So our combined spiritual energy is far more powerful than any solar flare or anything that can be created through these you know, wave of energy from the center of the galaxy. That energy is actually going to amplify whatever we choose for ourselves. So let's have it amplify the good instead of amplifying the fear and the conflict and the scarcity.
Well, I agree with you, and this is what this program is about in these conversations. Thank Mike Barra, the author of The Choice, formerly author with Richard Hoagland of Dark Mission. Thanks so much. That was a great conversation. And
thanks, Alan. Can I just mention my website real quick?
Please, please.
Yeah, it's www.mikebarra.com. It's one R, B as in boy, A-R-A, so mikebarra.com. I've got a monthly newsletter I'm just starting to put together. I'm going to be coming out with that every month. There's links to my YouTube, my Facebook, my Twitter. We've got a big cruise in the 2012 that is coming up in March that I'm going to be speaking at, along with Richard Hoagland and Jim Mars and Carl Kalaman and Daniel Brinkley and a bunch of other people you've heard of that are all involved in this 2012 stuff. So if you want to go on that, you can sign up there. And, you know, MikeBarra.com is the place where I'm going to be putting everything.
Well, thanks, Mike. I'm going to talk to you about a conference I want to put together about hyperspace and all that. So
sounds great.
Maybe I'll give you a call. But thanks for being a guest. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Check my website, newrealities.com. And I'm going to end with this song, Night Before the Future by Duke Williams. Let that spirit go through you. If I can't, oh my.